I observe what many of the French analysts and all my supervisees say. They are absolutely happy saying, but it's fantastic, the patients talk. They talk much easier than before. They have dreams, they relate dreams, they relate even sexual fantasies, which they never did before. And I answered them, of course, because they talk to you as easily as they would talk to a taxi driver that they will never see again.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Marilia Eisenstein. Marilia and I pick up from our conversation initially in March 2020 when the lockdown first began in Paris, and she had transitioned her patients from in-person to online work, as we all had at that period. And at that initial conversation, she reflected on what she saw going forward, how she anticipated this would play out in her clinical work. And now we revisit those questions. And she shares with us what happened with some of the patients she described for us, what she learned about the impact of online versus in-person treatment and the role of the body in analytic work, and also reflected on the valuable lessons we've all learned about what it means to be analytically flexible, what's essential about analytic work and what's not essential. She also shares with us her interests in literatures, in movies, in cooking, her deepened enjoyment of aloneness, and as an elder in our field, her reflections on where the field has been and where it is going, looking forward. Marilia is a training and supervising analyst at the Hellenic Society and at the Paris Society, where she's also past president. She has served on the IPA's board representative to the executive committee and past president of the International New Groups Committee. She is an editor and co-founder of the French Review of Psychosomatics and president of the Paris Institute of Psychosomatics. And her most recent book, translated into English, is entitled Desire, Pain, and Thought. My conversation with Marilia is like revisiting an old friend, and I hope you find it not only pleasurable to listen to, but quite informative as we hear how her analytic mind works facing the new crisis we've all been going through. Here's my conversation with Marilia Eisenstein. Marilia, welcome back to the podcast. It's good to be speaking with you again. Marilia, you and I first spoke back in March 2020. It seems like a lifetime ago.
Yes.
And at that conversation, it was a week into the lockdown in Paris. It was about that length of time that you and everyone in Paris, everyone in the world, had shifted from seeing patients in person to seeing patients online. And you and I spoke about what that experience was like. That morning, you had said that you were thinking of how to characterize what was happening to all of us. And you came up with the phrase, a community of soft denial, which I thought was a lovely phrase to describe the efforts we were making to make sense of this crisis that we were in, our patients were in, the process of analysis was in. And you had also wondered, given how readily everyone adapted to the online relatedness, whether patients would ever come back to see us. You're now in the office seeing patients live, and we're going to talk about what the transition has been like for you. And you had mentioned one patient at the time who stopped seeing you, saying she had just begun analysis about 5 months earlier, and she spoke about how meaningful the frame was for her. And she said, you know, I don't want to make the switch. I'll contact you when we're able to meet back in person.
Yes, and she did.
And she did, yes. I do want to hear about that. But start us off, if you will. You characterize Paris as being like a desert at the time back then. What's the state of Paris now, 16 months later?
Paris is now came back to a normal situation, but quite recently, because all restaurants, coffees, cinema, theaters, everything was closed down. And now it reopens slowly. We can have coffee or eat at restaurants, but only outside.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Only outside. When we go to the cine, to the movies, which for me is very important, I love movies, one seat empty between every two seats. And we must show our what we call pass sanitaire, sanitary pass, which indicates that you are vaccinated. We show it at the entrance of cafes and both movies and theaters.
I
don't know if you have that in America, but that is, I thought it was indispensable to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we have lots of people who are anti-vaccine, and they totally politicize the question of the vaccine as saying it's like being under a hard dictature, and they demonstrate in the streets, and that is a mess.
So it's not just in the States. It's also happening in France.
Yes, absolutely. You have the same in the States.
Yes, certainly. Now, when you go to the movies, do you have to wear a mask?
If I have to.
Do you have to wear a mask?
Absolutely.
When you sit in the movie? Oh, you do.
I have to show my sanitary pass, which is a sort of, I have it on my phone, on my cell phone. And you keep the mask, and you are supposed to keep the mask all time you are in the movie. That also, I can tell you that I don't really mind.
Mm-hmm. And for our listeners, we are recording this in mid-August, and circumstances obviously are in flux everywhere in the world. Tell us about your analytic practice. I was interested to learn that you've gone back to seeing patients in person, because there are many analysts who have not done that yet. There are many who, at least in the States, are planning to do that at the end of the summer, starting in September, and some are planning to never do that.
Mm.
I myself have gone back in the past few weeks part-time, and we can talk about that experience. But when did you start returning to the office and seeing patients in person?
I started immediately when the first confinement ended.
Which was when?
Which was, I think it was in April.
Oh, really?
Yes. We started in February and we finished middle April.
And were you wearing masks in the office at that time?
I was, yes. And I when my patients, I told all my patients that I was ready to see them in person. Most of them came back. Of course, we are taking a lot of precautions. There's a bottle of hydroalcoholic gel in the entrance. The couch, the silk things were replaced by medical paper. I change it. We wash our hands between every patient. All those are habits that are starting to be real habits. I mean, everybody does it.
Yes.
Now, I only have one patient, but I must tell you, she's heavily psychotic, who is so much afraid that she insisted to remain online.
Mm-hmm.
And I accepted.
Are all your patients vaccinated?
Yes, all the others came back.
Uh-huh. And reflecting back on the online treatment that you were doing and its similarities and differences with in-person treatment, what did you observe?
Yes, I observed what many of the French analysts and all my supervisees say. They are absolutely happy saying, but it's fantastic, the patients talk, they talk much easier than before, they have dreams, they relate dreams, they relate even sexual fantasies, which they never did before. And I answered them, of course, because they talk to you as easily as they would talk to a taxi driver that they will never see again. And I will add to this that it happens that I had a taxi driver for years in analysis in a hospital frame, and he would tell me how much it was unbelievably how his clients confessed to him unbelievably intimate stuff. And this man was totally overwhelmed by that. And I must say I was astonished. And then I concluded that taxis were serious competitors
sure.
Psychoanalysis.
Well, you mentioned an important point because I've heard that here in the States as well. People think that because patients speak more freely on the phone, that is a deepening of the work. And it skips the understanding that the work is deepened by understanding the reluctance to speak when you're in person. That's what adds to the intimacy and intensity and the freedom. I have a patient who returned to the office after we have been meeting online, and he reflected on the difference, and he said, I realize how much more intense my avoidance of feelings is with you present than it was with you on the phone.
Of course.
And he characterized it. He said, meeting in person as compared to meeting on the phone is like having sex without a condom, which I thought really captured the immediacy and rawness of the experience.
It's an excellent sentence.
Yes. And yet our colleagues often think that it's the content and not the nature of the defenses that is important to deepen.
We do not understand. They do not understand that, of course, the bodies, the two bodies being absent, it's so easy to talk because the resistances disappear.
Right.
But I'm very curious to know what will become all this material given so easily. Will it remain will be forgotten what will happen when one day everybody will come back.
Will the repression take over and they will have forgotten this or drained the feeling from what they have spoken of? It's a lovely question.
I'm sure the repression will take over, and probably the patients will be very ashamed of all the stuff they gave during online sessions.
But then the work can begin, as it was.
Exactly.
They can figure out what the nature of that shame is.
Yes.
I've heard from some colleagues that they don't plan to return, that they have found, both for themselves and their sense of the work, that it does proceed usefully online. Is that something that's common in Paris?
Yes. Yes.
Some people are planning to continue open-ended online, and I know some people have given up their offices.
Paris.
Oh, not in Paris.
Not in Paris. Not in Paris, because, you know, French psychoanalysis is quite classical, and you may know that before this crisis, this pandemic, nobody had worked online, nobody.
Right, right.
And it was, as I told you last time, our last conversation, it was even considered as a sin.
Yes, and we both laughed at that.
Yes.
Because it does usefully, I think, raise the question of the notion of sin or forbiddenness when it comes to analysis, because what we learn from it is that it may have been forbidden, but in fact, when forced to do it, there are aspects of it that are useful.
But of course.
And maybe... Maybe the other notions of sin or the other things that are considered forbidden should be re-examined as well. Maybe there are other ways that we need to be open to engaging in the process and with our patients that might also prove to be useful. But I don't know, what's your sense of not just how the patients will come back to the office, but how analysts will come back? Will they too come back with a changed sense of the frame?
This question is absolutely crucial because I thought of it a lot. Now, most of the French analysts, and especially all my supervisees, their patients are back in the office. Now, what did they learn of this crisis? I mean, both patients and analysts.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot for the moment measure it. I think we don't have enough après-coup. As we see, you know, the French people, we see après-coup as a real process which goes on and goes on. I think we don't have the real après-coup. It's too early.
And do you have a prediction for what will be learned?
I would think that the prediction is that maybe it will help, especially young analysts, to be a little more flexible. Because, you know, young analysts have a lot of fears not to be classical enough. And that can be terrible because they are not able to be flexible. And maybe this pandemic and the crisis will help them to understand that there are different patients and different circumstances.
That the analytic approach is to speak the patient's language and deepen it from there, as opposed to ask them to speak our language, to be pleasing to ourselves and our real and imagined supervisors in our heads.
Exactly.
That is a tough lesson to learn. I'd be interested in the impact of this crisis on that process. My own sense is that it takes time and clinical maturation, but perhaps this will speed up time. That patient of yours that you had said left treatment, you said she returned.
Yes. Yes, she returned the very first day when the radio said that confinement was over. She called about 1 hour later.
So she had been waiting.
Yes, she had been waiting.
Yes, yes.
And she had been, she had been psychically working.
She had been using the work you had done.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Marilia, let me ask you something broader than just to reflect on this period. You are one of the elders in our field. You've been practicing analysis for, you guesstimated, about 45 years.
Yes.
So you've really seen where analysis has come from, and you are in a position to reflect upon that and to consider where you think it's going. Now, if one listens to your words, one can glean a sense of how your mind works about that. But let me ask you directly, looking back on your career, what have you seen about the evolution of our field?
Look, when I started in Paris, at least at the Paris Society, we couldn't, for our control cases, we had to have real neurotic functioning patients. And it was the hell to find those patients. But it was then, the idea was that the other patients, I mean borderlines, psychotics, of course, psychosomatics patients, were just psychotherapy cases, and they could not be analyzed. This, I think, changed a lot. And it changed in the years, to me, my memories are, in France at least, it changed around the 70s, between 70s and the 80s. And really, thanks to the work in the society of André Green, who was interested in all pathologies and showed us that they could be all analytically handled. That was very important.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a big gap between before 60 and after 80.
And that's your sense of the growing change in the field?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I believe we have not complete and psychosomatic Paris School also, which was founded in 1962, but came to be recognized 10 or 15 years after, also was a big, big progress in the way confronting the patients and going on their field and not try to bring them in our field.
Right. Yes, that's often the challenge. And you feel that we're making progress in emphasizing the importance
yes,
of that.
Yes, I think we are still making progress.
Mm-hmm. And when you look forward and imagine the future, what do you hope for? What do you think will be?
Look, I think analysis will never die, because there are a lot of patients who are not the neurotic patients, but the others, the more ill patients, who are never cured with medicines, nor with short therapies, and they need really analytic work. Analytic work, that means to be on the couch, but you can also do very good analytic work 3 times a week or 4 times a week, face to face.
Sure.
So, on one hand, I'm very optimistic. I'm sure that despite all the critics and attacks, psychoanalysis will continue and certainly will never be forgotten. On the other hand, what is very difficult, in my idea, is to to always try and go on and have new experiences, but without throwing the Freudian rock, which to me is so important.
So learning the classical approach is essential for being able to apply it in extenuating circumstances.
I think, you know, Harvey, I would say that to be able to defer, you need to perfectly know the classical way.
I understand.
If you have embodied the classical way, you can make your own changes and be flexible. But if you don't know it, then you do whatever comes to your mind,
right.
And it's not good.
Yes. Aurelio, one of the things we spoke about last March was how you sustained yourself during this time. And your answer at the time was to describe some of your pleasures, your pleasure in cooking and sharing it with your neighbors, your pleasure in literature. At the time, you spoke of your enjoyment of Japanese literature, and you also said beginning to read Nigerian literature. You've added to that by talking about how important film is to you. What has happened to you in the past 16 months? What has grown? What has sustained you? What has given you pleasure?
Well, what you mentioned gave me pleasure and gives me pleasure. And, you know, I think that I accept much more to be passive, not to be able to go outside. And, you know, passivity for us is so important. But looking back, I think that I was always working or doing something, going to movies, going to theater, seeing friends, and so on. This long confinement changed a little my mind, and I'm more happy now if I spend a whole day home, cooking, reading, listen to music. I really enjoy it. And it also, for me, it made me enjoy more loneliness. One can be very happy being lonely because when you have a psychic life, finally you are never lonely.
Would you call that aloneness versus loneliness?
Yes.
I don't know if it's a language issue, but I think of and often thinks of aloneness as not a painful state, but loneliness implies a hunger, a distress.
Yes, you are right, but we have only one word
in
French, negative or positive.
It's a fascinating point, and I haven't heard it said before, though I think it's true for many of us. That aloneness, whether we are with people in our aloneness or not, we certainly haven't socialized in the way we used to. Famously, we haven't socialized. And I think we've all had that experience of discovering the comforts of aloneness, if we're lucky.
Yes.
And as you point out, that with a psychic life, it needn't be painful. It needn't be a hunger.
No. To me, it was not painful at all. It was a little odd in the beginning, but I found my marks quite quickly with cooking, reading a lot of literature, as you mentioned. And I continued. And now I'm rather in the Israeli literature, which is excellent.
Do you want to mention any particular author?
Yes. Lev Shalem, another who is very well known, Abraham Yehoshua.
Yes, Abraham Yehoshua, yes.
Yes, remarkable, remarkable. You also have, well, there are a lot of them. It will come back. Will come back. I don't remember now, because you know my memory, my immediate memory vanishes a little.
As long as it's only a little, then I think we're okay. Marilia, it's a pleasure to speak to you again. I was looking forward to our conversation with a particular sense. It was like checking in with a relative I haven't seen for a while, and we have this space of 16 months, obviously a famous 16 months in our personal histories, in the world history, and you are as vibrant in your thinking and your presence and your affective aliveness as you were then, as I assume you have been for most of your life. And it's a pleasure to touch base with you. I hope our listeners are able to get that sense of your vibrancy in our two conversations. I'm fascinated by what I've learned from you about how you and others are approaching online analysis and in-person analysis. I think the field is going to hopefully explode with insights and as we study this transition and your observations about the importance of being in person with the body, I think are powerful, important, will be controversial. But everything's controversial in our field.
Harvey, I will interrupt you to tell you that the importance of the bodies in the room of the two bodies was stressed by Freud very early in 1996 in a very beautiful, very short paper, which is called seal treatment.
How do you spell that?
Seal in German.
Ah, okay.
Seal in German is not the psyche, it's the soul.
Oh, yes. Psychoanalysis, psyche is the soul, not the mind, right.
And this paper is called Soul's Treatment, explains how important are the bodily roots in every thinking process or every single idea. And he explains that even speaking, exposing on a topic which is abstract, any man will have bodily reactions.
Which is now being demonstrated through neuroscience.
Which is totally demonstrated by neurosciences.
Yes, yes.
And I found this paper absolutely moving and amazing. So, I mean, we were talking before of the young analysts, the younger than me. They are, most of them are ranked younger than me. But I think it's very important to keep the Freudian roots of psychoanalysis, even if one needs now, today, to be much more flexible and to understand that the rules are to be respected, but can also be changed at some points with some patients and in some circumstances, as we saw with the pandemic.
Well, my understanding of your model of analysis is that the rule is to follow the patient.
Exactly.
And to speak their language and try to deepen it, of course, because that's the nature of the work and the purpose of the encounter, but to deepen it using their language. And that's the rule. I mean, it's kind of a paradox because it's a rule to not have a rule except to listen and learn how to follow the patient. Like we said earlier about analyzing defenses and about, yes, the freedom to speak is a good thing, but like you and I both said, like, why is the freedom only when we're not in person? What's the meaning of that?
Absolutely.
And I think that will be a lesson that will live beyond both of us, hopefully, that that the importance of understanding what gets in the way of our freedom to think and speak in proper settings is the gift of analysis.
Maybe I had already told, but doesn't matter. To be able to differ from a model, you must have embodied the model before.
Yes, yes, and embodied is a good phrase. Marilia, thank you. It's a pleasure both to catch up with you and also to continue to learn from you. I wish you more pleasures, both of the alone sort and also of the collegial camaraderie sort. And hopefully we will all have more of them in the hopefully near future. It's been a pleasure talking to you again. Thanks for joining us.
For me too. And maybe we'll do it again in 1 year.
Next time in person, for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.